It is 11 minutes now after 12 o'clock. Thanks, Kim Gordon. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on Friday afternoon. Steve Bertrand in. Big jobs report came out today. The number of jobs created even higher than expected. And as Steve Alexander has been saying, that Wall Street loves it. The Dow is up 366 points now. A little bit later this hour, we will be joined by Mark Hamrick. He is the senior economic analyst and Washington bureau chief at Bankrate. And we'll talk a little bit about the numbers and about the fact that it looks like more people now are entering the workplace, people who might have given up in the past. So that's coming up in the second half hour, as is, we're going to talk to a university professor who wants to learn how to grow rice in Wisconsin. And the idea is that he might help feed the world from just south of Madison or just north of Milwaukee. That's an idea that might be necessitated by the change in the world's climate. Before that, Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network, joins us, and he is on a phone line this afternoon. Tom, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve, for having me. I'm wondering if that's going to be cheesy rice out of Wisconsin.
You are the second person to say that on the air in 10 minutes, Tom Gimbel.
I'm not even an original anymore. Darn it.
So you're not here. I'm assuming you're skating at Rockefeller Center. Is that what's going on today?
I am in New York doing some business, but it doesn't mean that Chicago isn't the best business city in America.
Well, Kobe Bryant wrote a poem this week. Who would have thought? And in the poem, he did what I suppose a lot of us expected him to do. He announced that this would be his last NBA season. Which sort of begs the question, there are a lot of us who people think might be due to write our poem, and the idea that Kobe Bryant sort of knew it was time for him to go. He's certainly not the Kobe Bryant he used to be. But how does that translate for the rest of us? What can we learn from Kobe Bryant? And we sort of look around and maybe things have passed us by, or it's just time for us to go.
Well, I think there's two things you need to look at. You need to look at people who are at the tail end of their careers, and maybe they're going to take an early retirement package, so they're going to get a profit-sharing plan, or they're going to be able to get a pension or a severance and walk away. And then there's the people who are maybe earlier in their careers, in their 30s or 40s, and they've been at the same place for 7 to 10 years, maybe even longer, 15 years, and they're saying, hey, is it time for me to tackle new challenges? And usually you got to look in the mirror, and you got to follow your gut and where your happiness level is. And I think more than anything else, what we can learn from Kobe is when you're injured in professional sports, you're not playing at a high level, you feel that you're not contributing. Same thing goes in work. It may not be physically, but emotionally you're going to feel disengaged because you're not as challenged as you once were.
Well, right. So Kobe Bryant can look at the line score the next day and see that he only shot 30% from the field. If you're going to the office day after day, it's not so easy to see that.
No, but when you're going to the office day after day and you're not getting the key assignments, if they're being distributed amongst the company, then maybe they're sensing that you're disengaged. And on the flip side, if you're really getting your work done and it's more becoming more robotic and formulaic, that you don't have to think and be creative anymore. That's the same. It's the same as the box score. And I think a lot of people know it. They just don't want to admit it because change is hard.
Well, change is hard, and admitting that and walking away is hard. I mean, especially if you're at the end of your career, how do you broach that subject?
Well, I think, it can be very easy. If you're in a big company, and a lot of times they'll want to do severance packages the way that the economy is right now, and you may want to take it. You may want to take it and go on to phase two, and it could be consulting. I've seen stranger things of people actually going back to the existing company and consulting there at a different compensation structure, or working with consulting firms or smaller companies. I mean, a lot of it does come down to the difference between sports, where the analogy stopped being accurate, Steve, is because those guys have tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank, and a lot of us aren't making that. So we've got to look at the financial situation, which is really the hardest driver. And some think that's why Kobe came back, because he had a $30 million payday this year. So when you're looking to leave, you got to start lining that up, and you got to keep your network alive. I've been preaching this for almost 20 years. You can't be using your network only when you need something. You've got to stay in touch with people on a regular basis, several times a year, to make sure that they know that you're reaching out, not because you need something, but because you want to stay in contact.
You know, it's an interesting thing you raise. And so if you approach your employer and say, it might be time for me to turn a page, become a consultant, or do something like that, they might be hoping you come to them to say that. You know, I think sometimes, well, I do this. I have conversations in my head and assume people are going to respond negatively or one way or another.
Right.
Right? Without ever pursuing it.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of us start thinking before we think that we've had the conversation when we really haven't. It's just our thought.
Right. In my head, I thought you were going to say that was a stupid question. I almost didn't even ask it.
Yeah, exactly. So true, Stephen. So you go through this, but that's about having relationships internal. And you've got to have a relationship with your boss. And it's why it's so important, whether you're at this stage of your career or not, is to start developing relationships with people above you in the food chain so you can know what's going on. Because a lot of times companies are thinking, you know what, we've got some budget restraints, we've got some changes going on, we may be doing a sale or an acquisition, we want to shed some salaries. And the best way to do that sometimes is for someone to take an exit package. And if you're north of that 55-year-old Mason-Dixon line, you know, we don't want to talk about age discrimination, but if you're thinking that you might need a change, don't leave without seeing if you can get a package.
You know, it's interesting what we're talking about this in this way, because Jan and I are working on next week's programs, and one of the subjects we're going to talk about on Monday is, and you sort of approached it early in the segment, are the younger workers. You know, I'm sort of focusing on the older workers who are looking around and realizing it might be time. But there are studies out now where younger workers, and we'll jump into this a little deeper on Monday, but, you know, they're on a new job at 2 and 3 months, and they're starting to look for the next one.
Yeah, I'm a big opponent. I don't like that at all. And I'm seeing people, I think you really need to stay at a job for 4+ years. And the earlier in your career, the more important it is. You got to build some stability and track record. And it goes back to the whole, you know, participation trophy when you're a kid thing, where if, you know, when we were kids, Steve, if you had a hard teacher or a hard coach, your parents would say, you need to suck it up and fight through that, because one day you'll have a bad boss.
The coach is always right, yeah.
Yeah, today's day and age, you get a bad boss and you want to leave after 3 months, and somehow people think that's acceptable. It's not. And you need people to fight through it, because creating a resume, a really strong resume, is like working out. It's creating a really strong core in your midsection. It's what the real fundamental health is of your career. And that stability, especially early on, is crucial.
All right, now be honest with me. We got just a minute or so left. I have been at this job, at this company, for 30 years. If I walk into your office or walk into an employer's office, having been at one job for 30 years, is that now seen as a positive, or I suspect it's now seen as a negative?
Yeah, I think there's probably a little bit of a negative slant to it, and not because you don't have the skills or the loyalty is a huge positive, but the aspect is how adaptable are you going to be to change, and what's going to be your learning curve of a whole different culture. It really gets more into culture and where your mentality is, because now you don't have any emotional capital built up. And after 30 years of having it at the current place, when you go into a new place, you got to fight every day to show them what you're about.
See, that voice in my head told me not to ask you that one, and I did anyway. Tom Gimbel, thanks for joining us. Good luck with that business venture in New York City.
I look forward to seeing you next week.
That's Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network. You're listening to the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. It's 12:23 on the Business Lunch in Chicago. Time for a check-in with Blue Sky Innovation. The editor, Andrea Haynes, is with us on this Friday afternoon. Andrea, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, I'm interested in... We had some people on from Glassdoor several months ago. I don't remember exactly what the topic was, but they seem to be sort of an evolving company, and now they're moving into Chicago. They started as a site where you could sort of rate your workplace, right? And what are they growing into now?
Yes, it was very interesting. It was a place, it was almost Yelp-like, and, you know, still is, where people can go and sort of anonymously say things about what's going on inside their companies, which is always interesting if you're searching for a job or just curious about a company.
Or if you're running a company.
Yes, or if you're a business journalist. Now they're, you know, they've moved in previous years into being more of a full service sort of job board, job postings. Companies can pay them to list their own information, their own content on the site, including jobs. And, you know, it's a recruiting tool.
So they've gone a little bit from Yelp to Career Builder.
Yes. Yeah.
And Career Builder based here in Chicago. And now here comes Glassdoor to Chicago, right?
Yeah, Glassdoor is definitely ramping up its presence. They are opening a Chicago office in 2016, and they say they plan to hire 250 people in Chicago over the next few years. So they have salespeople and others, you know, on site here in Chicago to work with companies, try to sell them services, and try to buff up their presence on their site.
Well, maybe that answers my question, because it seems like this is a web-based business. So what does their location matter?
Yeah, I think it's for sales and for sort of coaching, you know, just getting out there they're selling to people, managing those accounts, and, you know, offering these sort of consulting services almost, it sounds like they're planning, where they will sit down with you and, you know, get your presence to where you want it to be for your recruiting. And
so they went from a clearinghouse for workers to talk about where they work to now helping businesses figure out a way to make workers talk more nicely about where they work.
I guess monetizing all that, you know, all the information about what's going on inside the workplace.
And is this a basically U.S. business, right? But I read that they're also moving in toward Dublin.
They are. They're also adding there. So making a big push to expand.
And Google expanding? Are they expanding here or just moving into new digs?
Yeah, so Google's been growing since it got here in 2000. They moved into a big new office, which is interesting to Chicagoans because it's in this sort of West Loop warehouse district that's up and coming. There's a lot going on there, but
is that
Google,
the, is that what the area that the city wants to call the new innovation district?
Exactly, okay. Calling it the innovation district. You know, Google says it feels like it's almost an anchor tenant there, obviously, with its name and its size. That makes some sense. They're occupying six floors in a building that used to be an ice warehouse. So it's kind of a cool redevelopment project as well.
And so what does it mean for them to be an anchor there? There are little sort of satellite innovation companies around them, or are there like restaurants? Is that what they bring in? Or what
yep, they're in? Sort of all of it. There's others in the building, including Sandbox, another, you know, health-focused accelerator. So there are other, you know, other businesses in that very building, also others in nearby buildings. There's a big new steakhouse. There's new restaurants coming in, just kind of, you know, edging that push west.
Have you been over there?
I have not been over there yet. We've had a couple people go tour the space, and I would love to go do that.
Because I remember now the Innovation District, I talked to a vice president at the Poynter Institute about whether you can design creativity. You know, and I guess that's the big thing. They're trying to design these innovation districts around the country, really. And this is Chicago's shot around Google. So we'll see if how they do.
Yeah. And there's big, you know, always, of course, talk about people colliding and ideas colliding and that leading to more things. And also just generally people being trained in tech and in innovation and what they can bring to every company that they ultimately work for.
Right. So you used to like to work next to a Chipotle so you could get lunch. And now it's so you can bump into someone else and change the world.
Exactly.
That is Andrea Haines, the editor of Blue Sky Innovation. Thanks for coming by today.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It is 12:36 on 720 WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch just ahead of a nice, warm, balmy weekend. It's the kind of weekend you might want to grow rice by. Well, maybe, maybe not. Let's go to Wisconsin now. And Professor Michael Schlappi, a microbiologist, molecular biologist, I should say, at Marquette University. Michael, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Oh, hi, Steve. It's a pleasure talking to you.
All right. So, you know, I know that, and maybe people would be surprised to know that they can grow, and they do grow tobacco in Wisconsin, but you've set out to try to figure out a way to grow rice in Wisconsin, and
correct.
I want you to tell me why.
Well, several reasons. So this is a part of my research. I'm researching, like you said, I'm a molecular biologist and geneticist, and I'm researching stress tolerance in plants, and especially crop plants. So I used to use a mustard or plant before that was a model system, but I switched to a crop because, you know, it's much more fundable, it's more interesting, it's more important for everybody to work on a crop plant. But plants can't throw, you know, walk away or fight when they're stressed, so they need to adapt to the environment. And rice is a very, very important crop. You know, it feeds about half the world's population. And believe it or not, 80 or 90% of the rice we grow in the States is actually consumed here. But we grow even more and export it. So to keep that, you know, going, to keep this ability going, I think we should be able to or introduce rice to the Midwest, because due to climate change, you know, California has a lot of drought and this might be going on. So they might be losing acres and acres of rice production in California. What they lose there, we might be able to introduce into Wisconsin or the Midwest per se.
Well, I like the story. I like the story on a couple fronts. And one is that the idea that you're trying to proactively solve a problem that might be headed our way.
Exactly.
I also like the fact that you built rice paddies on a building roof in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
That's correct. Yes. So yeah, that goes into the idea of urban agriculture as well. Milwaukee is pretty big in urban agriculture, and we have, if you look outside your window, probably you see all those flat roofs, right?
Sure.
And they're completely useless. They're not used for almost anything, and that's unused space. So you can actually grow rice on patties on a rooftop. So this worked phenomenally well here at Marquette University. I have a flat roof right outside of my lab. And we built these, raised bed patties with a pool liner and some soil, and then just flooded all the time. And if you translate, or if I translate what I get there in the patties to an acre, I would get up to, 5,000, 6,000, maybe 7,000 pounds of rice, which is pretty good.
And what's really good, 8,000?
Yeah, 8,000 is what the... about 8,000 is what they want to get in Arkansas or California. So it's pretty close to that.
I don't want to derail myself, but if I wanted to build a rice paddy in my backyard, I mean, what's the yield like? Could I ever grow enough rice to actually harvest and benefit from?
So let's do the math. I mean, if you do a 4x4 paddy, it would give you about, ideally about 2 pounds of rice.
Okay.
And so if you, if you scale it up, 10 by 10 or so, you can get a couple dozen pounds of rice. And if you don't eat too much rice, that can feed you for a couple weeks.
Actually, Professor, that could feed me for years, I'm afraid.
okay.
But so you're trying to find this. And, rice is grown, right, in cold climates. It's grown in cold parts of China and all of that. So was it hard to find something that would grow in Wisconsin? Or are you sort of engineering something that would grow in Wisconsin?
Well, yes. So we could use, for instance, there is a group in Vermont who likes to also introduce rice to the Northeast, and they're entirely relying on Northern Japanese varieties, which is great. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture that is funding my research, they have like 20,000 varieties of rice, and they reduced them to about 203. Which represents, all the varieties throughout the world. So I've tested those to find the one best suitable for the Midwest. And there's a couple that are really suitable. For instance, there's one from southern Russia, which is relatively the same latitude as we are, about 43, 44 north.
Mm-hmm.
And that one has all the properties that I would think is necessary for growth in Wisconsin. So it makes probably up to 8,000 pounds per acre. It is cold tolerant, so you can plant it early, even in mid-April, believe it or not. And it will flower, make grain early August, which is also still warm and not too cold. So I think that finding something like this, so through screening and selection, I think that's the best way of finding. And then of course you can find others.
And so once you make this discovery and you've identified the best possible plant. Then do you sort of become a Johnny Appleseed? I mean, are you going to try to convince people to grow it in Wisconsin?
That's a good, and I never thought of this. That's actually, I'm going to use this. That's a very good analogy. Johnny Appleseed, yes. I think, that's a big part of my, I shouldn't say vision, but at least, forward thinking, if you will, because of the issues with climate change and so forth. I think, yes, I like to convince people to grow it in Wisconsin. So it can be grown on a rooftop. You don't get too much, right? You need an acre or more to get a good yield. But I think the benefit of growing rice here, for instance, is that a lot of people like locally grown food, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
To reduce the carbon footprint. Right now there's this big conference in Paris, right, talking about reducing carbon footprint. And instead of flying it here from California or China or Japan, if you can grow it locally here and just drive 10 minutes to, from the field to the store, that is very interesting for many people. And I think they're also willing to pay a little bit more for that than, if it's the other type of rice. And therefore, I think we can convince even small-scale farmers to start, right? If you get $5 per pound, you just need a couple acres to have a nice income. So
I like that part of it. Here's the other thing I like about this story, Professor, and we're talking to Michael Schlappi from Marquette University. The other thing I really like is that I'm reading that you're on the south side of Milwaukee, and you've gone into this community center, and we have these elderly Lao and Hmong immigrants who are planting rice again for the first time in decades. These older ladies who did that as child in their childhood are now doing it again in the last days of their lives and sort of revisiting that. That's kind of an amazing thing.
That's correct, yeah. So I was approached by somebody who's in exercise physiology, and they're working with the Hmong community, and these women that are in their 80s and 90s, they're really elderly, and came here as refugees in the 80s. So since the 70s or 80s, they have never touched a rice plant. So we tried to convince them to do something in terms of exercise, but in their language, there's no word for exercise. It's always work.
It's called life, so right? Yeah.
It's just like, it's called life, exactly. So when we presented them with the idea of growing rice, that really piqued their interest. And it was a great experience because they loved it. They thought, you know, of course, they were joking with me that I know nothing about rice, which is true. Uh-huh. It's not completely true, but they were, you know, that they immediately remember their expertise, and it was a great experience for them.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm sure you brought, you each had very different knowledges, right? You brought the scientific knowledge, and they brought the knowledge of feel and life and all of that.
Exactly. So it was a great combination. But we'll do it again next year.
Yeah, it's a nice thing. So you might be changing the world, and you definitely are changing the lives of some immigrants here as they get older. It's a very cool story. Michael Schlappi from Marquette University. Good luck to you. And I expect a rice bowl sometime in the fall.
Absolutely. I'll send one to you.
All right. Good luck. Nice talking to you.
Okay. Thank you. Same here.
Bye-bye. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Steve Alexander, Kim Gordon, and Dolly McCarthy.
You're
Steve
welcome.
Bertrand here. And I've got to learn to stop doing that because Alexander answers me every time. You know, Steve, you're talking about the jobless numbers and just again, 211,000 jobs added. And then they upped the numbers for October and September too, right? So that was maybe, what, another 35,000 jobs?
Yeah, revised the numbers upward. And also wages went up a bit as well, about 2.3%, I believe. And so the typical American worker is now making about $25.25 an hour.
Mark Hamrick is the senior economist, economic analyst, I should say, at Bankrate, the Washington bureau chief. And he joins us now on a phone line to kick this report around. Mark, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so let's start with that jobless report. So the numbers were a little better than expected. People were expecting pretty good things. But it looks like more the unemployment rate, the jobless rate, stayed at 5% because a lot of those people who'd gone away had sort of given up on finding a job apparently are giving it another shot, which I think is a pretty good sign, right?
Yeah, I think this is being roundly thought of as a positive employment report. And, you know, like boxing, when we're watching the economy, the thing that you worry about is the punch that you don't see coming. We took a pretty heavy body blow in 2007, you know, resulting in the financial crisis and recession. It's nice to see the economy proceeding in a way that seems like it is sustainable. To the extent that, you know, it's not off to the races with the kind of jobs creation we're seeing. But the good news is that barring the truly unforeseen or disastrous, that this recovery seems to still have legs.
Right. And to continue your analogy, the punch that everyone sees coming is the beginning of the interest rate increases probably coming up in what? Where are we, the fourth? So 11 days from now.
Yeah, hopefully that's more of a glancing blow than it is a knockout.
Yeah, I guess I didn't mean it as something that was going to injure us, but it's something that's coming.
I appreciate the extension of an analogy at any point.
You got to give me a little latitude.
Absolutely. So, you know, Janet Yellen and her colleagues at the Federal Reserve have been saying every which way they can that the world should expect the central bank of the nation's largest economy to raise interest rates on the 16th of this month. And coming into this report, some people were sort of positioning it as the last key piece of data the Fed will look at. Of course, the Fed's looking at all the data, including to that that comes in overseas the days of their meeting or meetings. But I think even coming into this report, barring the truly disastrous, and I really do mean that, I didn't think that there was much that could wave the Fed off at this point. And I still feel that way. And because, you know, they really want to get off of this zero interest rate policy, which effectively removes their key tool from the toolbox when things do slow down or get bad down the road. That happens at some point. We just don't know when it is.
You know, and I got to say, Mark, as someone who doesn't really invest so much in it but just talks about it, I just want it behind us. I mean, let's just do it so that we can find something else to talk about, because it seems like it's all we've been talking about for 6 months or a year from now.
I hope to be able to talk about it for quite some time to come, but that's because that's my living.
Right. Yeah. You can talk, for sure. The construction jobs were up. That was good. The jobs for the motion picture industry were down by 13,000 now. I don't know what that's about, and I don't mean to hit you with a curveball. I don't know if you've looked into that. But
no, I did see that, and I don't think that it's easily explainable. I think the point that the Labor Department made alongside that data was that this is a one-month occurrence, that the employment in that sector seems to have been unchanged in the last year. And don't forget, you know, this is a survey sample. It's very often that, not necessarily sector by sector, but for the picture overall, they will revise the data. And it could be that, you know, something was happening in the industry and something happened in the particular month, but it's not indicative of something that is necessarily worrisome. It's a valid question.
So people, one of the things that that is cause for concern with this recovery has been the fact that wages really haven't recovered the way the numbers of jobs have. And now that the unemployment rate is where it is and the number of jobs being created is where it is, the experts are saying that there will be more pressure on wages and we might start to finally see more increases. Is that the way you see things?
Well, you know, this is the sort of piece where economics, being the dismal science, tries to say that this time will be like every other time in the past, when truly none of these times are exactly the same, right? But it just does follow that as the job market becomes quote-unquote tight or tighter, that wages should necessarily go higher. But, you know, there are so many competing factors these days, not the least of which is the relatively new entrant in the puzzle overall, and that is the globalization of the economy. The other piece is the ridiculously fast pace of technological change, right? I mean,
sure.
You know, if you're like me, you're carrying a smartphone, and it has more functionality than you're really able to even exert, to the extent that you can buy your movie tickets, make a bank deposit, and do all the things that you actually bought it for. But that, you know, also has displacement of other employment opportunities. So with all those things happening all at once, I don't know that it's necessarily appropriate to say that this time will be like all the others, but there has been some good news here recently, to the extent that the key gauges of not only wages but also benefits and wages overall have been on the rise. But, you know, the Fed's own Beige Book survey that's prepared for the upcoming Federal Reserve meeting this week spoke of a very few instances of overall wage pressures building sector to sector. It's more of a entry-level worker thing, obviously, where parts of the country where we've seen increases in minimum wage, that has had an impact. There are selected sectors such as high-tech manufacturing jobs, highly skilled jobs where people have to be trained to get those jobs, and certain areas of the country where construction workers are in short supply. It tends to be those very limited areas that are seeing more substantial wage increases. And, you know, for the plight of all of us, meaning that we all have a stake in this economy together, we can hope that the lifestyle and the standard of living of all Americans does continue to improve. But I think it helps to speak to some of the political the anger in the political debate that's out there, that many people, you know, are trying to figure out why this time does feel different, and it's for all those reasons that we just talked about.
Mark Hamrick, the Senior Economic Analyst, Washington Bureau Chief for Bankrate. You helped us understand the numbers today. Thank you very much for that.
You're very kind, and thanks so much for having me. Have a great weekend.
You bet. You too. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.